Come on. Hello and welcome to Dynamite Neddy. It's the retro games podcast where a couple of owl pals get together and talk about a couple of owl games. The voice you're hearing just now is myself, Mick Clockerty. Joining me, as always, we have Mr. Andy Mack.
Konnichiwa.
And Mr. Mick McCormick.
How's it going?
Boys, it's been a long time. Been a wee while. Listeners, we had been trying to keep to a 2 per month schedule, which we'd been doing valiantly, but you always end up with that fucking cunt of a month or a couple of weeks spell where the stars just never seem to align. I couldn't get my game working. I had to cancel. Andy had to cancel. Stuff just kept coming up. But this should be us, hopefully, back onto your regularly scheduled Dynamite Neddy.
Yep.
What basically happened is that in Scotland, the sun came out of its hiding place for the first and probably only time this year. And like all schedules went completely out the window. Everyone was taps off, they were having barbecues, they were like going for drinks after work every day in the week, stuff like that. Chaos. So couldn't really keep up with the schedule, I'm afraid.
Big news in the, I mean, and this is podcast related, right? I mentioned it to yous on one of the other chats. Very sadly, Ange Postecoglou has gone to take the EPL dollar. He is no longer Celtic manager.
Is it too soon to call him a fat mercenary bastard?
No. I mean, not for me, because I'm quite disappointed. Maybe listening back, I'll be like, I should have pulled Andy up for his big gravy guts there. But,
See, that's the thing, man. How fickle is not fickle enough? Because, I mean, a guy fucking came, and even there was a quote from him that said that, oh, I think you are going to be surprised by how long I'm here, you know that?
Yeah, fucking, well, I mean, that's the irony, we are surprised.
I didn't know he was a Cockney.
But aye, man, it's like, just be honest with fans. But you can be a capitalist and want to look after your family, which is fair enough.
You can't nurture the level of buzz and belief for the fans and the players if you are sitting quite matter-of-factly going, yeah, well, I mean, the goal for me is always to be top five in England, you know. I don't really care what happens to Celtic after that. I'm ruthless and I want to have a really good career. Who the fuck's going to believe in you?
Game. It's like when you're getting your review and work and it's like, oh, where do you see yourself in a year? You don't say it fucking somewhere else, man.
Tottenham Hotspur, mate.
I want to win the lottery and never see you guys again. Like, you play the game.
Aye, that's the thing, though. It's sad because we're laughing at us, but do you know, that didn't seem that crazy, a concept of somebody staying with their team for a long stretch of time until very recently, like the last 20, 30 years.
They're not saying these guys are rolling contracts as well, which I think is maybe more common these days.
Ugh, man, see the whole agent football system, it's all consolidated into a syndicate now, where it's the same faces that pop up. You've got your elite manager bracket, which is like Tuchel and Mourinho, and fucking that guy at Man U and Guardiola, and they all have their own like Premier Division of managers, and they kind of fall down the rankings and up the rankings, and it's all fucked up, man. You know, how many times has somebody come in for like a youth team and absolutely killed it? Do you know what I mean?
I know what you mean. The only reason I've started is with a sports corner here, this aside, is because it is tangentially related to Dynamite Neddy. And I'll tell you for why. If we see a mass exodus of Japanese Celtic players, Andy's embargo on discussing war crimes on the podcast will be lifted.
Oh no. Japan's goodwill has been spent, unfortunately, so all bets are off.
Aye. I feel like getting Japan a wee break, man. They've had it stinking over the last 4 years, haven't they?
Well, I mean, they've... As I say, they've been getting a pass for a wee while now. We did have that bumper episode when Shinzo Abe was
Aggie
Thatcher. when he was killed by an improvised shotgun, which was tremendous.
Good on
some buzz. No.
And Hideo Kojima amazingly escaped all charges for that. I don't know how he managed
that. Where is he, man? Is he going to make a fucking another Metal Gear Solid game or what?
He's what? Konami, if you look up a wee bit about Konami and their business practices, they're pretty shocking as a company. But he's kind of... I don't know if he's fully parted ways with them, but he's not on good terms with them. He's not involved in these remakes that are coming out, the remake of Metal Gear Solid 3.
Aye. They should just get right back to bare bones and make another stealth game like that, man. Just get right back to that stealth component, hiding in a cupboard.
He made Death Stranding, which is like a mad warehouse thing.
Aye, I've heard of that
which
one.
Which is like, I've not played it, but I'm going to play it at some point. It seems like Hideo Kojima completely unhinged and like, nay, restraint put on his creativity, and it's just mental.
That one sounds good.
If Polis Knots is anything to go by, then I guess Stranding involves like slapping women's arses or like watching them get changed or something, maybe turning invisible.
He's a wee bit older and he's got family and that now, I think. He's calmed down in that pattern a bit.
We have got breaking news. I've just had a message in a group chat. I never do this. I'm clicking on to another tab here. Somebody has just helped me that on something called Summer Games Fest, a new 2D Sonic has been announced.
Fuck off. What?
So, this is something a wee bit fucking different for yous, given that this probably isn't going to still come out for about a week, but we've got live reaction here. They dropped a Sonic trailer there while we were fucking recording. gents, Sonic Superstars, first looks, what do you think?
Oft, McCormick, Cosmonaut, you go first.
It looks interesting. I think, you know, they're finally fucking realising what the fan base of Sonic fans that spend the money are, is that people, saddos like us in the 30s, so they've got a kind of new game made by, it seems like, the sort of mainline Sega team, which is very inspired by the 2D games, but we have kind of made a modern look to it. It looks pretty good. Your guys are kind of moving like Sonic in 2D, but with a few extra kind of bells and whistles, seen bits of them kind of running up a kind of half pipe in the background and kind of things going on, things kind of jumping towards you in the background and all that stuff. Four player, which could be interesting as well. I think it looks not bad. Cautiously optimistic as always I'm with Sega, because they find ways of fucking everything up a lot of the time, but
yes.
You know, first impressions are pretty decent.
I would go one under cautiously optimistic. I am cautiously tepid, maybe.
Cautiously cautious.
Yes, cautiously cautious. I've been burned before. You know, this is, as I said, for me, it was giving me Sonic 4 vibes.
Yes.
I've seen this. Do you know that Back to the Future meme? Hey, I've seen this one. I've seen them say, oh, look, we're doing that Sonic that you like, but we had an updated look. I hope they prove me wrong. I hope this is a cracker. I just don't know. I don't see what was wrong with just getting his mare of Sonic Mania. The art style works. The control system works. I know you've not got the fellas that work on it anymore. There was like a bump bridge there. But I mean, for me, that's more what I would like to see for Sonic going forward. But I suppose I'm a bit of a Luddite.
There was a period at which I think they were trying to say, okay, there's like sort of two fan bases here. There's the older ones and there's the Waynes, and we're going to make games for both of them. It seems like now they're just back to trying to thread the needle and please everyone, and maybe it'll please no one. I hope
they've finally reached a point where they're going to smash it, and they've meshed these two things together. And it works. Andy Mack, I heard you watching the trailer, and you could not contain that childlike enthusiasm that Blue Hedgehog still brings out in you.
Aye.
I'm guessing you like the look of this. And...
Aye. You've got to be careful with these games. We all get stung. Remember with Sonic 4? That leaves a bit of taste in your mouth this day, because all they did was promise the world. This is taking up right after Sonic 3 and all that. And then what we got was a fucking bloated mobile game split into like two bits as if it was like a Java title or something. It was shite, didn't have a movement in. And I thought it kind of looked similar to it at the beginning, but then I looked at the movement, and this is pretty accurate, man. This looks like a Sonic game. This looks like just get the momentum spot on. It's got wee quirks. It's got things like jumping up the... I noticed the jumping up the water fountain thing. Like if you're in water, you can bounce up. There's other things too. There's a lot of kind of things for Sonic too, like the vertical kind of slopes and stuff. They've brought that thing back where you can kind of run into a background. And as you said, they've brought a special stage for Sonic 1 back. I don't know, they've done that before, various results. Also, new levels, they've got this kind of a Pac-Man kind of base level.
I like the look of that one section they showed you where the four players had turned into these kind of space invaders looking like octopi things.
Aye.
I'm quite intrigued by that.
Aye, aye.
It's like a
trolling
going on.
Aye, that's new. That looks like a new type of... Well, something that maybe they've took it for Sonic Colors or something. It's got that sort of aesthetic, guy. But it looks good, man. Like, no, that way, like, you kind of get too excited. Sega always fuck it up at the last minute. But
aye.
This looks like it's going to be fun. I mean, it's back to lightheartedness again. Sonic Frontiers had this... Oh, edgy... teenagers wanting to whatever, but this it seems to be like back to its roots and colourful and happy and just running about mental, which is good.
A cartoon character running about fucking collecting doodads. We need more of that in the world. There you go, something a wee bit different for the intro, a live reaction.
We were wondering what we were going to do for the intro, and then all of a sudden, a vote for the blue.
Planets aligned.
Come Sonic to save the day.
What the biggest news of the year,
Shout out to my old pal Sean Kirk for that one, who is a listener. He just dropped that into a group chat I'm in, and I had to pull it up, because obviously we were doing this. So nice one.
Aye, brilliant.
Right. That brings us on to our first game of the evening. We're going to talk about NBA Jam Tournament Edition, which, you know, way back in the before four time, I gifted to Andy Mack to play. The reason I went for this one is because you always feel on Dynamite and Eddie that you've covered all the big hitters, and maybe in terms of the Mega Drive and your own personal library, you have, but there's oftentimes big ones that we've missed out, and NBA Jam for me is just one of the best sports games of the 90s. Very simplistic, but you know, you get next to a pal on a couch and you could just play it over and over again. When me and McCormick stayed in that Gorbals flat with German Toby, a couple of bifters, and me and him could sit and just fucking play each other NBA Jam over and over again, you know, best of three, best of five. I loved it, and I guess you probably had played it before, Andy, but it was more just to get a re-perspective on it. So how did you get on?
I remember this from back in the day. I did play it. It was one that popped up quite a lot. I can see it as clear as day in my head. The cartridge for this one, the box, sort of black background with a ball on fire. A Spalding ball on fire, quite a good one. It caught your eye. When I played it, I always thought, right, here's basketball. And this is one of the ways that I learned how to play American sports. Like, I still watch American football a wee bit because I like the rules there. And this kind of showed me the rules, like what travelling was and what a backcourt violation was, and where you had to shoot to get 2 points and 3 points. So I remember back in the day, this game doing a lot for me. But obviously, I'm revisiting it more than 20 years later. And when I started it up, I was like, right, I remember this. But the thing that got me right away was, the game, I remember in my head, has been a full four-player basket sim. But this is a two-player arcade game. You've only got two players on the screen at once.
Yes.
So instead of going the full, is it four or five players usually on a basketball team, you've only got two. And then that unlocked all these sort of memories of playing this back in the day. And I remember that it was a game that was based on pressing buttons at the right time, rather than sort of manoeuvring your wee guys about and like, running about and stuff. And at first glance, when I was playing the game again, I was trying to play it with that kind of way of thinking, like, right, okay, try and run past this guy, like as if I was playing FIFA. But I found out that the game was a lot more arcadey than that. It just requires timing things properly, being in the right position.
We've hit this note so many times before, if you listen to the FitBus specials, but...
I was just having deja vu there myself.
In terms of, is it an arcade game or is it a sports simulation, NBA Jam is firmly in the camp of an arcade game. I mean, it's like basketball, but it's no... I wouldn't really say it's a close simulacrum of the game of basketball.
Mm-hmm. Aye. So I played the 32X version. Whenever I can, I like to play 32X version of Mega Drive games, because I never got around to it the first time. And sometimes there's extra things like better graphics, and I know it was impossible to get.
I'm going to say it doesn't happen very often. 32X had about 10 games out for it.
Well, that's true, aye, but this happens to be one of them, and the graphics are really good. The sound... it's just the same as the Mega Drive. I can't hear anything special. Maybe it's just because the music's kind of crap, but I'll go over it in a minute. But when I played this game at the start, I remember thinking, oh, hi, I remember this. I remember this. And then I started to kind of get false memories about, I know there's a setting in here to control your second player and things like that. And there wasn't. You could only control one player. But part of the intricacies of the game is trying to get your other player in the right... areas of the basketball court in order to either pass the ball to you
I think you can switch players, can you? Aye. Maybe select or something like that. I think it's one of the weird buttons.
Alright. Well, I've just been going...
You can only control one guy at a time, but if you pass the ball, you don't automatically just become the guy with the ball.
Aye, that's right. Aye.
Game. You would have to pass it and then say, okay, I want to control him now, and then press another button.
Aye, it's like a weird control, isn't it? But, apart from that, it's basketball, essentially. Kind of like World Day, 2-on-2. If you obviously score from outside the box, it's 3. If you score from inside the box, it's 2 points. You just keep going to each other for 4 quarters. I found that I could never really get a lead. I could never get like a 6 or 8 point lead. I found that it was like back and forth, and it was really difficult to stop the AI for scoring.
Again, I think it's like with certain FIFA games, if you're only playing the computer, it can be a bit fucking tedious. Particularly from like back in the day. Do you know when you're playing against a pal and you manage to fucking get like a half court 3-pointer shot? That's a really big get it up you moment, do you know what I mean?
Aye.
Especially if you then run up and fucking score again and get like a good 5-point lead. But playing against the computer, you know, they always just seem to be able to knock the fucking ball away when you're shooting. They always seem to be able to just knock it out your horns. It can be quite hard if you're playing against the computer.
Also found if you went to somebody like Chicago Bulls or New York Knicks or the Boston Celtics, like the better teams, then you would have you could score from anywhere. So every 90% of your shots would just go right in.
Were the players you played as, like, was that their team for that year?
Aye.
Kind of well-known?
No, this was a big one for probably an early example of a computer game with all the bells and whistles in terms of image rights.
Aye.
The correct players were in the correct teams and they had, you know, wee profile pictures, aye, and stats and stuff like that.
Aye, because you could do things like, it counts how many slapaways and blockages and that you do. It shows you like a wee stats screen at the end of your game. It counts up all these kind of things you do, which shows me that the game's a lot more in-depth than what I'm actually seeing. You've got like this full big defensive system that completely changes when you've not got a ball, and then when you've got the ball, the game completely changes into a totally different way of thinking about it. But the bit I found really difficult was tackling. I found that by the time you even... this was a big criticism for me. They would throw the ball to their man and the camera would take too long to catch up. By the time the camera's caught up, they've already scored. That happens in FIFA sometimes, like at certain stadiums. And there's not a lot you can do about that. Sort of reminds me of like, if you're playing online and you get a bit of lag and it's a pure unjustified goal. Like... I get that kind of thing with it. And again, I think this is because, like, right, what is this game? This game is just a 2-on-2 basketball game at heart. And maybe after about 16 games, it becomes a bit samey. But there is quirkiness to this game. Everybody's got a big head, which is quite funny. There's funny noises, like you've got a turbo bar that can make you like day slam dunks and shit, man. And
the commentators shout, "He's on fire!" And
he's
stuff
on fire!
Your guy will literally go on fire and burn the net away
boom,
and like
boom shakalaka and that.
Aye,
smash your backboard with your dunks and stuff.
Aye.
You've also got Honors are fucking weird treats, particularly in the tournament edition. Been able to play as fucking Hillary Clinton.
I see that.
Prince
I played.
Charles going fucking full sicko mode.
I played as Prince Charlie, right? And when we were talking about these cheats for this game, I was expecting for them to like, be wearing their civvy clothes, like their normal clothes. So I was expecting like Bill Clinton to be running about in his suit and that, and fucking Prince Charles to be full regalia on, but it didn't quite work out that way. They were still wearing the shorts and t-shirt and stuff.
Aye. It's just their heads, I think. Just heads on top of another player's body, because obviously they want to go and animate them. Get Charlie in his studio and fucking motion capture them.
It does get you a profile picture for him.
Aye, it does get you. It's like a stock fit, aye. It's like a stock head shot of them, aye.
Do you think every time you bought a copy of this game, they had to like give money to the Crown Estate and that?
I don't know.
He's bought a few more pheasants for that.
I think because it's hidden away in cheats, it probably wasn't well known.
One thing that really impressed me about this, I don't know if it's just the 32X version, but the crowd, man. Like, now FIFA's getting crowds now where every person looks like a person and not like a bit of cardboard.
Aye.
Some wrestling games have done it so far now as well, but this game must be one of the earliest to do it. Everybody in the crowd all moves at different speeds, so it looks like a big crowd. Now, I don't know what that says about me watching that shit, but it's pretty dynamic, it looks good, man. It's for a Mega Drive game. But I don't know, as I said, I'm not sure if that's just the 32X version or what.
Andy, who was your team?
So I went the Denver Nuggets.
Interesting.
Abdul Rauf and Matumbo.
Were they players you liked, or did you just think it was funny that they were called Nuggets?
First, to begin with, I thought, aye. I was going to, obviously, you go, ah, oh, cool, where are the Celtics and that Scottish team? But they're not there in Scotland. And then you've got, I certainly couldn't go to the Colorado Spurs.
No.
So I went, I said, I don't want to go Chicago Bulls because, I mean, obviously, the Space Jam, and this came out about the same time, which has been before Space Jam, and I mean, Chicago Bulls were like Brazil, weren't they? The fucking Man City at the time.
Well, see, McCormick can go the Bulls because he stayed in Chicago, right? So you go, right, you're allowed that one because you lived there. otherwise, you're glory hunting somewhat. I mean, obviously, it was a bit of an arms race if you were playing your pal to see who could get to Boston first because you wanted to be Celtic. If I wasn't getting the Boston Celtics, I always went for a team called the Charlotte Hornets, because I liked the Mad Hornet logo.
Ah, right, yes, aye, very valid. By the way, but, for the Nuggets, right, Matumbo, what a slammer, he's brilliant, right? He is the type of guy that will get beat a full game, right? And the other team will be up by 8 points, and then he'll hit his turbo mode late in the game, and he'll just go fucking absolute, he'll just go on an absolute slam, what was I going to say, a slam spree, is that too cheesy?
Aye. No. See when you get them doing the fucking somersaults and stuff like aye. That, flying away up in the air.
That's a good bit.
Satisfying as fuck.
This game's a bit like a wire, right? And like, see when you start off the. when you start off the game of basketball, right? For the first quarter, it just kind of there's not much going on, right? And you're getting humped, and you're finding that there's not much to this game at all. But see, as your bar gets up, your turbo bar. And as you learn how to like kind of steal a ball, tackle, and you learn like kind of it's not as you're thinking about it too much maybe, and just kind of keep pressing buttons and trying to time things a bit better though, it becomes a lot more fun. And then as you said, Mick, out of the blue, you'll do like this big fucking somersault slam thing, and you'll be like, this is fucking cool, and the balls start flashing, and everything you hit, when the ball flashes, you just score everything.
So again, getting. retreading well-worn ground once again, getting back into simulation versus arcade. So as you were just saying, when players' feet go on fire and they're, you know, somersaulting up in the air and doing big daft dunks and things like that, that is when this game is at its most fun.
Aye.
And part of the thing I liked about Tournament Edition was that you could put cheats on so that it was always like that. You could make your fucking players teleport and things like that, or you could put a mad turbo mode on so everybody was constantly going fast as fuck.
I'll need to check the cheats out, man, but one of the most dopamine inducing parts of the game for me, we all like a bit of dopamine, didn't we? Was when you take a ball off some stupid cunt right outside the box and just go, fuck it, I'm going to go for a shot, and see when that ball goes in through the hoop, you get a kind of a wee dopamine hit, but I draw a flag.
Scoring a three-pointer is probably about the same level of, ooh, that feels quite nice to your brain, as taking a draw of a fag if you're a smoker.
Aye, even though I don't know how much you've actually got to do with it skill-wise, I think you've just pressed a button at the right time, but...
Aye, is it a dice roll for whether it hits half the fucking rim or not, do you know what I mean? I don't know.
I played it with an analogue stick, so I was kind of like kidding on that I was having an effect on the flight able and that. It was a bit obvious that I wasn't there, man. But aye, it's pretty cool. I like how mental the crowd goes. I like I just like everything that's going on. It's very alive. The animation's good.
It's one of these ones that we need to add to a new very long list of we'll need to get together and play this sometime.
Aye.
Couple of tins, sit next to each other on a couch, and it's a fucking great time.
That's what we're missing, man. We've no excuse not either with the emulation scene at the moment, and
I know.
The thing is, this game, right, I think you're right, I think you are spot on in what you said. You can have fun with this game, right, but sometimes my thinking all gets skewed. I sat down and thought, tournament edition, Magic, this is going to have something like the World Cup in it, or the NBA Championship, but it didn't have a tournament in it. Basically what it's got is like an arcade mode where you've got to keep winning.
My classic, like, here's a question for the guy that doesn't know anything about the sport in question, but like, if this was like a quote unquote serious basketball game, what more would there be? Like, what more can you do other than just having more players? Like, or some sort of management type mode? Like,
well, the new NBA games have got sort of every player's got their own position in games. That's the main difference between a sports arcade game and a simulation game.
Aye.
Defenders, they're defending, attackers, they're attacking, everything in between. And their attributes are usually very nuanced, whereas in arcade games you'll maybe get a rating out of 5 for each thing or something.
You're going to have, as Andy says, positioning. So you're going to get more defensively minded players who are not going to be getting the ball and running up the court trying to score every time effectively. Whereas you're playing a 2-on-2 quite arcadey thing. If you've got a ball, you're just running with it. You're holding in the sprint button and going for it. Or seeing if your partner's open, passing it to them and trying to get in their advantageous position.
You're not finding openings and stuff like that.
Have you ever played like World Day, right? And somebody that's just doesn't pass. World of Dubs. Just doesn't pass. Greedy, what you call it, innit? You're greedy. Aye. What are you doing? That's too greedy, man. Like, as if he's the only cunt that's paid for a game of fives or something. That was me, baby boy. I never ever passed it, man. I just try to skin them all and score all the time, maybe to my detriment. But
I've had this exact experience playing basketball, even.
Aye, you're just kind of here for the furniture. You need to pass the ball. You get all the time, man. Exactly. To make up the numbers.
This was how McCormick ended up in the south side of Glasgow. He was chilling out, maxing, relaxing, all cool, shooting some b-ball up the QB. A couple of guys that were up to no good.
But aye, basketball, man, it's like something that's sort of culturally relative in some ways. Like, you're taught it in a curriculum in school, but kind of, it's kind of, in some ways, it's kind of alien to you. This kind of indoor stadium sport with 50,000 people running it, watching, and it's
quite good crack. Or rather, before they moved there's a whole thing about the British Basketball League, right, where Glasgow had quite a good team in it. They were called the Glasgow Rocks, and they played at Velodrome just over for Selick Park, and that was quite good. See, just for, I mean, you didn't really take it as seriously as a game of football. They, for me, play too many stupid wee sounds and tunes and stuff like that, just wily games going on. But you could drink a beer and that at it. It was quite good crack. But they've moved the team to East Kilbride and changed their name to the Caledonian Gladiators,
which is just
a shite name. I don't, I don't get it. I don't get what Gladiators has to do with...
Well, Scotland.
Aye.
So, might as well call themselves fucking Swansea fucking Bricklayers or something.
And basically what they've got now is a Scotland national team playing in the BBL, because there's no other Scottish teams. So that's just supposed to represent the whole of Scotland. But rather than being in, like, fucking, I don't know, Glasgow or Edinburgh, an actual city that people would flock to and be a good place to travel to, it's an East Kilbride.
See, basketball, I think Scotland's got a decent basketball repository of players, but other American sports, I remember the Scottish Claymores were here, right? And they couldn't use any Scottish players, because I don't know if you've ever seen a Scottish gridiron team, a Scottish American football team, but the players are usually made up of beardy incels and the most non-athletic people you've ever met in your life.
picturing a full side of that will be getting bleeped.
So I don't think there's much hope for those type of sports, but we do the cracking version of Rounders.
We'd
be able to play them at baseball, I think, if we got it right.
You're kind of halfway to a recommendation there, I think.
Well, listen, let's play a two-player and then talk. I feel like I only got half experience, but there's a good game here. It's fucking, I can see why people revere it, man. It's Moorish, it's very addictive. That feeling when it goes in the net, buff. The way the ball moves, do you like looking at the ball? Crowd looks beautiful. I like all the sounds. Who's on fire? Blah, blah, blah. Man, I've played some bad games on there. An NBA Jam ain't one, right? Just let's have a two-player, and I'm sure I'll see this game in a completely different light.
Magic.
But this would have been four-player in the arcade.
Yes, Mick, it looks like NBA Jam was a four-player stand-up bad boy. Looks pretty fun.
There you go.
Those are always cracking.
Oh, and, we should also mention the arcade is where this game is top of the pops. It's meant to be the best version. And as you can imagine, as it is made by Midway, creators of Mortal Kombat, who Andy is also big fans of. Aye, but maybe get ourselves along to Barrio or something if they've ever got it in.
Aye, man.
Aye, all right. That'll bring us on to our next game of the evening. Andy, why did you pick Landstalker for Mr. McCormick?
We've not had a good fucking action RPG in a while, have we? I think we've done a couple, if I'm right, or maybe a long time ago now, but we've never really looked at the ones on the Mega Drive. Mega Drive had some amazing examples of action RPGs. Obviously it had its RPGs like Phantasy Star 4, which was incredible, and a real contender to games like Final Fantasy 4. Final Fantasy VI, maybe a bit of a stretch, but
I mean, you go a way back, cast your mind back to the simpler days of 2019 and episode 1 of Dynamite Neddy, and we had Salil on here.
Salil, yep, that was another one. They call them Zelda clones, but they're not really, especially in that example. But this one, I can see where the Zelda sort of comparisons come from. It's an action RPG game with slight differences in basically every aspect of the game. The game's Landstalker. It's one of the classics on the Mega Drive, mate. So, just wanted to see what you thought of it.
Aye, so, yeah, as Andy says, it's a kind of action RPG that was out for the Mega Drive. There was a few examples on the system. Not Hunters, but I think if you had this one, you know, it was quite possibly the first action RPG you'd ever played, or if you had it for that system, it was kind of unlike anything else you would have been playing at the time. So yeah, this is a game that came out in 1992, and it was by a team called Climax Entertainment, who weren't a massive studio. I think they worked on, like, as one of the kind of, like, I guess, backup or expansion teams that worked on Shining Force, and they also had a few folk that were veterans of the Dragon Quest series, deciding they wanted to make an action RPG. I think this was initially going to be like a spin-off, actually, of Dragon Quest, but it ended up being its own thing. So in Landstalker, you play as, and by the way, terrible title, you're not stalking anything. Stalking through the land like some sort of beast is not really what you're doing in this game. And continuing the kind of bad names, your main character's just called Nigel, Which, I don't know, maybe seemed heroic to someone. Maybe he's named after one of the developers' creepy uncles or something. But yeah, Nigel is he's a treasure hunter. And at the start of the game, you get this intro that plays underneath the credits. And it's pretty cool. You see him on a quest through this dungeon. It's very Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Uh-huh.
I think he even gets chased by a big boulder at one point. But he's going through this kind of dungeon, and he finds a statue, which he's going to take back to the toon and sell for a few bob. So I like this. He's not your kind of teenager thrust into a quest that he's wasn't prepared for or anything like your classic JRPG protagonist. This guy's a treasure hunter. Is what he does.
He's a bit of an arsehole. Has he not got a touch of the Wario about him?
I mean, not that I can remember, but I mean,
or is it the fairy that's a bit of an arsehole?
The fairy is a bit of an arsehole, yeah.
Right, that's what I like the fairy. That's what I like.
Aye, so he goes to sell this statue, and then all of a sudden there's a wee noise with the statue, and he finds that there's this fairy inside. I've been trapped here, but she tells you about this treasure, the legendary treasure of King Noel, and she's been chased by this. She's got Friday, by the way, not really sure why, but she's been chased by these other thieves, a trio of thieves called Kayla, Ink and Wally, because she knows where King Noel's treasure is. King Noel's treasure is worth a fortune. So Nigel kind of thinks, oh, brilliant, this person could lead me to this treasure. And she's like, well, I'd rather you have it than them. So he heads off, he hires a bird as a kind of form of transport, and it carries him to the island where the treasure is. And he's been pursued at the time by these three thieves, which for some reason as well, and I'll get to the dialogue in this game, but they speak in like kind of like African-American English, weirdly. They tell him they're quite fooling and that he's had enough jibber-jabber. I don't know, there's a few unusual kind of dialogue choices in this game. So in terms of this kind of setup, I think there is something to be said for games, particularly RPGs, that do away with all the kind of preamble, and basically it's just like, here's the island where the adventure happens, and you will start off being there. Like, you don't wake up, you're getting told you're late for school.
Aye.
And then like your village gets burnt down, and you're kind of put on reluctantly onto this quest. It's just like, right, boom, there you are. You're on the island that's full of monsters and treasure and dungeons and all that. Just have at it. I quite like that. Yeah, I like how it didn't really mess about.
It smelled like a Sega attitude, innit? It's like, fuck up, a wee guy getting woke up, no, it's time for school and all that. This guy's been at it for years, man. He's radical. And he's got better ears than Zelda Day, or Link, whatever you call him.
The game is in an isometric perspective, which I'm not going to try and explain, but it's pretty obvious from kind of looking at screenshots or videos of this game. It's kind of unusual perspective, and it means that basically you're mainly moving like diagonally around, and it's kind of a way of like representing like three dimensions in 2D without being like actually 3D. So that's the kind of main difference from something like a Zelda, is that you're kind of, rather than a kind of top-down view, you're moving in this isometric way, and it means you can jump as well, jump around a platform. The main kind of thing you're doing in this game is really walking about and fighting monsters with a sword. And you can get upgrades to your sword and upgrades to your shield, get a power kind of early on, which is like a magic ability for your sword, which means that it takes a while to charge, but then if you do hit an enemy when it's at full charge, it sets them on fire. But you're not really getting the Zelda sort of additional items and items that you can use for like solving puzzles. Like, you're not going to get a bow and arrow or a boomerang, stuff like that. And therefore, you're kind of going through these wee toons and dungeons and stuff, but mainly the challenges in the dungeons are platforming or just kind of battering loads and loads of baddies before you run out of health. And I kind of miss that element of Zelda, the kind of element of like puzzle solving and kind of having to switch up between different items and weapons and things to use. Like, just going through the dungeons and slashing away at baddies, it's got a wee bit tedious, to be honest. The combat in the game isn't particularly great. And I was kind of trying to figure out if this was like a contemporary of A Link to the Past. It came out a year after A Link to the Past, but I think it was in development, probably overlapping sort of times.
Aye, man. I honestly, looking at the character, just the way he looks and the design, It's definitely Zelda, man, isn't it? It's definitely Zelda-ish.
I mean, he wears all green and he's got pointy ears.
He's an elf.
That's a deliberate choice. For
He's wearing a bit of green too, like a tunic, and he's got all this going on. This game is heralded as one of the few masterpieces on the Mega Drive, right? Maybe when it comes to, in terms of an action RPG, if you take this one, Beyond Oasis and Soleil, this is usually the one that kind of rises to the top and is always used as an example of the best. But the main criticism of it is always about its graphic style, its movement. It's an isometric game, which is a bit different for any other action RPG, which gets a lot of criticism. What did you think?
So I think that the isometric nature of the game means that the platforming is very difficult, at least for my brain. Because it's a kind of false, like, 3D perspective, you can't always really tell whether something's like in front or something else or behind something else. Mm-hmm. It's like those M.C. Escher paintings, like you kind of trick your brain. So like there's one particular bit where I was like, there's jumping on moving platforms that are kind of moving like left, diagonally left to right and diagonally one in over the other. And I couldn't really wrap my brain at that at all. I was really just kind of jumping it randomly, trying to figure out if I was going to land on this or if it was actually meant to be somewhere else.
It's like, see when it comes to platforming especially, platforming as a concept is so fine-tuned to like using your directional buttons that northeast, southwest, you're jumping right, you're jumping up, you're jumping down. This seems like an exploration into dynamics of diagonals. It's not really intuitive in our brains because when we think of platformers, the way they've been designed is like you use absolute kind of directions, but now we're saying sort of diagonals. It kind of fucks me up.
The jumping puzzles in this were just an exercise in frustration. There was a couple of bits where, you know, you had to keep going back and retrying it to fucking get across a ledge or something like that, and it fucking get really tedious.
I did a good bit of save stating on this, just purely like every time I reached a new platform in one of these difficult bits, I was like, right, save state, because I'm going to mess this up and I'm going to start again. It looks really nice with the isometric projection. I think it lets you know, kind of have that thing we were talking about with Final Fantasy Tactics, where you've got this kind of nice wee diorama that you're seeing. Although I guess because this game is fully 2D, you kind of rotate the camera around, which maybe would have been helpful to kind of line up your jumps and things. But yeah, it looks nice. It's kind of, when it's kind of static screenshots and stuff, it looks great. But yeah, the platforming is a bit annoying, and the combat is a bit bland. Like, most of the enemies, if you're standing still and just swinging your sword constantly, they will just keep coming towards you and you'll eventually get them. Nothing's firing projectiles at your end, and it's mostly just like you're being a bit of an HP sponge. Most of the time it's just who ends up gets enough hits in. Although there was, as I was getting a wee bit later in the game, there was kind of skeleton enemies, and they had a bit longer reach on them, kind of longer reach than you, so fighting them was a bit more interesting because you had to kind of fall back a bit and kind of like time your strikes to hit them and stuff. But yeah, I found the combat a bit bland, and the baddies took up a lot of hits before they went down. Although I did like the design of the enemies. That's one thing that I thought was pretty cool. They're just the wee sprites of them, they were pretty nice. There's one, a snake with a mohawk, that I thought looked pretty radical. There's also like these wee mushrooms, and they just look like normal mushrooms, but when you walk past them, they jump out and they're kind of monstrous, and they've got these big horrible lips and that. The graphics and that were good.
I don't think this game fails anywhere in like the charm department. It looks nice, the tunes are pretty good.
Yeah, for sure. And I like the kind of story and the dialogue as well. So like the first when you first kind of land in this island, you go right up to the King Knoll's sort of his palace where his treasure is. And you get up to you get so far enough through the dungeon, but then you end up falling through the ground, and you just like get swept away by this current of water. So it's kind of like it's like a false start, really. And then you fall into this village full of these wee bear people for your heed, and they look after you and stuff. So yeah, and you find out your adventure's maybe going to be a bit more difficult than you thought.
The writing's always cited as being like kind of quirky in nature, but No, obviously, not as genius, but like in the same vein as sort of Earthbound, where it's a bit offbeat at times.
Yeah, it is a bit. It's kind of funny at times. Like you've got these two villages full of two different wee bear creatures. Some are red fern, some are yellow fern, and they've been fighting for ages. Nobody really knows why. And then, like later on, you got another town that's been accosted with thieves. That gives you a pass, like a kind of merchant's pass that lets you into the big city of Mercator, and that was my favourite place in the game, because that's kind of like, if you imagine a sort of merchant trading town like Hamburg or something, it's a bit of a den of iniquity.
Aye.
You've got all sorts of stuff going on. You get folk like selling monsters. They've caught monsters in the dungeon, they're selling them on a black market. there's a brothel, or what you think is a brothel.
Aye.
And I'm not sure how
that is a brothel.
I'm not sure how much of this is in the Japanese version, how much is just a translation. Tone and Dune thing, but you go into this place, and then there's all these kind of clad women, and they're saying, "Oh, we take care of the members in here. You know, you're not allowed in here if you're a Wayne." You talk to a character, a guy in there, and he says, "Oh, I'm a member of this place, but I'm not wearing my tutu just now," which like that raised a lot of questions to me. But
did you get back with your dog?
Hold on.
Sorry.
I need to tell you the story of this place.
Go for it.
You go in, you find out basically that one of the soldiers, you are getting the castle, one of the soldiers for the castle has been frequenting this place. So you follow him, but you don't get allowed in because he says you're too young for this place. So you go to a fortune teller and they cast a spell on you that makes you look like an old man. And then you go into the place and you follow him in. But then what you find out is actually it's not a brothel, it's a ballet school. Folk go there and they put their tutu on and they learn how to do ballet, and it just really de-stresses them. And you kind of go in if you're a Wayne, because it's some of the exercises might damage your growing muscles.
Aye.
That was pretty good. Also, like, there's a wee lassie outside in that place, and she says, "Do you want to be my boyfriend?" And if you say yes, the wee fairy gets raging at you and calls you a pedo and takes the life off you. I'm wondering how much of this was in the Japanese version, how much was, I'd say, kind of quirky translation.
There's a bizarre bit in this game where just at one point some wee guy says to you, "She's going to turn into a dog, you better run." "No, wait a minute, you're already a dog." And then you play a bit of a game as a dog. Did you do that bit?
I don't think I got that far.
I can't remember that either.
There's definitely a bit with a dog in it, and it's like you play a dream as a dog, and then you have to meet the witch that turned into a dog and all that stuff. You've got to press a switch that's next to her, but you've got to guess. It's like a puzzle to get a right switch to make a big spike land on her head. It's quite funny, man. Aye. There's loads of good...
That all stuff's pretty good. There's kind of funny scenes in that, and the story is quite good. Some funny wee references in the dialogue and stuff like that. In terms of like charm, there's a few nice wee touches.
Do you find a big difference between like quality Zelda puzzles and like puzzles in this one? I found like a lot of the puzzles were just like Zelda puzzles, only like, see the spikes and stuff. The most innovation you would get in this game is they would maybe change speed, whereas in Zelda they would have like all sorts of scripts for all the different obstacles and things to kind of throw you off. This one seemed like they were just messing about with kind of fundamental trivial things rather than like coming up with innovative ideas.
Yeah, I mean, aye. Zelda dungeons, when they're at their best, are like an absolute kind of masterclass and like creating puzzles and interlocking puzzles and like, you know, guiding you through all these different rooms and kind of getting mastery over the dungeon and that. But again, these ones, it's definitely not quite there. As I say, it's a bit limited because all you can really do is fight enemies, pick up keys, open doors. But yeah, I got, and they probably aren't as long as a Zelda dungeon and something like Linked to the Past, but they felt longer just because there's less to do in them.
Aye, there's a lot of kind of just aimlessly walking about in diagonal lines as well, and jumping and doing like, there's platforming sections where there'll be like maybe four or five screens and you're like, hold on a minute, what is the decision for this bit of design here? It's kind of boring. It's been the same thing for the last 10 minutes.
Yeah, some of the bits are a bit kind of barren. They're like, they feel a bit too big for what actually needs to be in them.
Aye.
In the dungeons.
On the flip side, it's a big adventure that you can play on the Mega Drive. There's not a lot like it.
Yeah.
And it's held in pretty high esteem. It's still remembered as a bit of a classic on a console. As you said, McCormick doesn't have a lot of these games. It's your Nintendo heads that kind of got the best ones.
And you know, it's, if we're being brutally honest, it's no hitting the heights in A Link to the Past. It's no hitting the heights in A Secret of Mana. For me, it's probably no better than Soleil. But it's by no means a fucking bad take at the genre. If you want a pretty good wee fucking action-adventure game on the Mega Drive, you know, this one's fucking there.
It's interesting they've took Isometric King and stuck with it. Seems like something that would happen like in a kind of prototype stage that would get binned because everything at the time was kind of overhead view and
It was a popular.
I know, aye, there was games about it at the time, aye.
No, I was going to say earlier. See, when you look back at C64 and that, for instance, a lot of adventure games were designed with this kind of tile-based isometric viewpoint. I think it was a way to sort of trick the eye into thinking it was quite graphically enhanced.
Aye.
I think some of the games that this took inspiration from as well was Zelda, was the old, in I assume these eventually made their way to Japan, but the old, like, Spectrum and Commodore 64 games made by Rare, really old Rare games like Night Lore and stuff like that, they were kind of like isometric adventures where you'd be picking up boxes and putting them down and jumping on them and things like that, so there's a bit of that as well. It's not all Zelda, but that's a bit of a kind of left field influence.
One of the other ones that are kind of in that vein as well, slightly different, it's made a puzzle game, Light Crusader, a treasure game.
Aye.
It's not like a treasure game at all, it plays completely differently, but it's got a bit of class in it. That's one for the podcast in the future.
Well, Mick, recommendation?
It's not a huge recommendation for me. I think if you want to play an action RPG on the Mega Drive, the one I'm going to say is Soleil, from way back in the day. I'll prefer that one. I think there's a wee bit more going on in that one. But it does have its charms. You can't take Eki-Ekis in Soleil. that's your health item in this game, which I've got a wee kick from. I got through a lot of Eki-Ekis to get through this game because I wasn't very good at it. But yeah, a lot of charm to it, but gameplay maybe leaves a bit to be desired, unfortunately.
There we go. Well, that brings us on to our final game of the evening. I don't know, Mick, do I ask you why you picked Shadow Madness for me, or do we just kid on that? Do we go 1984 and the game has always been Kirby?
Ach no, we can be honest here. Shadow Madness was an RPG that I had, and basically I tried to get Shadow Madness off my dealer, my Kobe Games dealer at the time. and he didn't have a copy of it because I looked at it and it was like, well, this is like Final Fantasy VII, this is going to be great. And the guy was like, are you sure you want to play this? He was like, I've all got a copy just now, but like, play Lunar the Silver Star Story, it's much better.
But did your guy know about his RPGs and that, the guy that sold you?
Aye, he had all the American imports and that.
He's like a weed connoisseur, man.
But yeah, I did eventually play Shadow Madness, and it wasn't very good, and I wanted Mick to play it, but he'd been saved by the gods because Kenna didn't work in the emulator, and the ROMs were a few and far between, because I think it's a bit obscure. So yeah, like emulating that, so I gave him a backup choice, which is another classic platformer of a series that we've actually probably not touched at all in this, and that's Kirby. And I think probably the first, actually no, I definitely played the Game Boy one first, but the Kirby game that I enjoyed quite a lot, which is Kirby Superstars, is it All-Stars Superstars it's called? I've forgotten.
Kirby Superstar is the North American name for it, albeit you probably played it on a fucking emulator to begin with because nobody had a SNES, but if you had done in Europe, it was called Kirby's Fun Pack.
Aye. Kirby Superstar is the one that I would have known it as then. This is a cool wee game, one of the kind of later outings for Kirby when he's kind of fully developed as a character. And this game, is the structure is a bit kind of interesting as well, which I think Mick can talk about it. I played it on emulator, as I said, had a lot of fun with it, and hopefully Mick did as well.
Aye, This is one... I mean, right, let's get into it, I suppose. Since this is the first outing of this wee character, Kirby, we were going to get... We've spoken a wee bit about Kirby Golf, actually, on one of the Sonic fan game specials, because there was a Sonic Golf game and it was based on Kirby Golf, and I was going to get Kirby Golf on an episode of this, but it just never ended up happening. But I mean, what is there to say about fucking Kirby? He's a wee pink ball.
Aye.
You know him, you love him. For my money, probably Nintendo's greatest ever B-side.
Brilliant. Aye, he's a wee fatty. He always turns up sort of at the end, doesn't he? Like, you don't see Kirby as a launch title. Kirby always comes, he's always last day party, isn't he? Bringing one last final hurrah.
He always gets a run out on the latest systems, do you know what I mean?
But
he's
actually
in the mix.
But when Kirby game comes out, you know it's going to be fucking spot on, because it's... By that time, the devs know the fucking system inside out. So they end up with this pure... some of the graphics and the... Some of the stuff they pulled off on that Kirby Superstar for the SNES is fucking just amazing.
It's the old Nintendo gold standard, knowing to change just enough so that it feels totally revolutionary, whereas Kirby games for the last 20 years have basically been at their core the exact same, but they stay fun.
Aye, they don't really feel the need to push the envelope with them as much as they do with a Mario or something. Like, it's not... The Kirby games aren't necessarily a system seller, but it means they're probably better for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, one of these characters that, if you've not played one of the games, you're probably at least aware of them. Do you know what I mean? For me, going back to the Nintendo Free Zone that I alluded to, which was being a wee guy in Europe, I played Kirby on the only Nintendo console that anybody really had, which was the Game Boy. I think Mick, you were saying actually that you'd played it as well, Kirby's Dream Land.
Yeah, Kirby Dream Land was the first one I played. That's a great wee game. And that's Kirby, like, in his kind of embryonic form almost, because he's not even got his most famous power.
Yes,
which is copy enemies' abilities, which he used to the great extent in this one.
Aye.
And he's white, he's not pink on the box.
He's white on the box, aye. Although that's supposedly an error, and he was always meant to have been pink or something like that, but I don't know. For anybody knowing the know, Kirby basically has two powers, right? He can fly, where he sort of inhales loads of air and puffs up into a wee sort of balloon, flaps about and can fly in the air. And he can also eat people and either spit them back out to cause damage to other enemies or swallow them to then copy the ability that said enemy has. So I don't know, if you see a wee guy running about with a sword, you eat him, Kirby will get a sword ability where he'll look like Link and he'll be running about with a wee sword. You see a guy throwing fireballs, Kirby will eat him and turn into a fire variant of Kirby. Kirby's Dream Land didn't have this, but it was a nice, easy wee... Do you know what? It was like a kind of shallow end for platformers. It wasn't mindlessly easy, but it was just good enough to... See, as an introduction to a genre, you probably couldn't get much better. Very forgiving.
Aye. The ability to fly made it like quite easy, I think.
Like Tails and Sonic 2, sometimes you could take that extremes, certain levels of Sonic 3, where you could just... But then Nintendo designed the game with kind of your ability to fly in mind, whereby they still made it quite easy, but you couldn't like fly off a fucking map or anything like that. Which...
I mean, you could bypass quite a lot in Kirby 1 by flying, but they weren't particularly trying to make a hard game, I don't think. But anyway, talking about Kirby's Dream Land is a nice seg into today's game of Kirby Superstar. I'm just going to call it the Yank one. Usually I would use a European name, but nobody fucking is going to know it as Kirby's Fun Pack. The first game mode on Kirby Superstar... Kirby Superstar is a collection of smaller games. So you get a few bite-sized adventures, you get a few mini-games, and the first game mode is an abridged remake of Kirby's Dream Land called Spring Breeze. So it's basically just Kirby 1, but some of the levels have been merged together, some of the boss fights have been cut out. But it's a good wee nostalgia hit if you remember the Game Boy one fondly.
Aye.
You know, like,
it's a great wee jaunt. You can finish it in about 15 minutes or something. Oh,
aye.
Any wee halfway decent of games, but...
Aye, yeah. You get that tree boss. I always remember the first boss in Kirby. a big tree with a face and he shakes apples on top of you.
He's brilliant, I like him.
But yeah, and I think the reason they took the decision to make that an abridged version is because putting the copy ability in Kirby 1 makes it too easy. some of the abilities you could just breeze through fucking Kirby 1. Maybe that's why it's called fucking Spring Breeze.
It's a good wee introduction to the game, how it works as well. I think because this is the first one on the SNES, the previous ones have been on the Game Boy, it's maybe try to reintroduce this to a new audience. I think Dreamland 2 was where you had your copy ability, you just get like one special ability from absorbing these items.
Aye.
But with this, you get, like, when you absorb an enemy's ability, you get like a whole new moveset. Like, you get like, you know, with a sword or whatever, you get all sorts of different combos, and like a jumping attack and a combo attack, a ranged attack and stuff like that. And you can also do this thing where you sacrifice your ability, but you like summon a wee companion. And he has all those abilities, but he's just kind of acts on his own, and he just he kind of does his own thing and fights enemies for you.
Well, I mean, this was where the two player came into it. So rather than being like AI controlled, you know, if you spat out the parasol ability, you get a wee guy called Waddle Dee controlling you. But if you plug player two in, that's who your pal would be controlling.
Aye.
That's what I was going to ask you, right? So Kirby, right? Fat wee pink legend, right?
Right.
Wee feet and that. Magic. Uh-huh. Wee black beady eyes and all that. Quite a cool wee thing, right? But there's a Pokemon Generation 1 that is very kind of... It reminds me very much of Kirby to a point where it might be plagiarism.
Jigglypuff.
Aye, man. What do you think? What do you reckon?
I wouldn't call it plagiarism. I mean, they're both in... I think they've both been in Smash Bros. For pretty much day one. And they're pretty similar looking in that. But I don't know. Jigglypuff's got the big clatty anime eyes. And is a different sort of shade of pink.
Just because they're kind of fat, squishy and pink, you know?
They gave Jigglypuff that kind of flying about like a balloon ability in Smash Brothers as well, I think. But yeah, they possibly are quite similar.
They look like they're three same tune. Look, one's very pork, one's very Greenock.
Obviously, Kirby is the Greenock one then. The pork can have Jigglypuff. The second game mode in the pack here is called Dynablade. Again, this is very much like the first gen. It's a Kirby platformer. You got about four levels, some bosses, power-ups and secrets along the way. Instead of fighting King DDD, this time you're fighting a giant robot bird called Dynablade.
Magic. A wee little bit more challenging.
Yeah.
Not by a whole lot.
And there's secret levels you can do in it, and there's also an enemy boss that goes about... It's got a kind of Mario 3 overworld, and you can look at where the secret boss is and run to try and find it.
Now, this is on a personal level. On Neddy, you can really tell when we get each other games... you can really tell when Wanny is really enjoys it, because we send a lot of screenshots to the group chat and we spend excessive amounts of hours on it. And I can just confirm that Clotterty did dedicate a full day to this with the interruptions, which was pretty cool.
This is me going, here are the other five games and then here is my one. So I'm trying to get these out of the way. You've got one called Gourmet Race. Just a racing game where you're having a foot race between Kirby and the King. Eating Fid makes you run faster. I was shite at it, could not get very far in that. There are two mini games. There's a quick draw game called Samurai Kirby, which is quite fun. You'll get like a 3-2-1, and it's fastest to hit the button, eliminates the opponent. It's good on two player. You got another one called Megaton Punch, where you mash fuck out the button, and then you punch into a planet and see how powerful your punch is. For the other two kind of platformer style games, you've got one called Revenge of Meta Knight.
Ooh.
This is... You know about Meta Knight, right? He's in Smash Bros. And that as well. He's probably the most iconic Kirby villain. He's sort of like a wee blue version of Kirby, but he always wears this kind of iron mask.
He's got a wee mask, guy.
He's got wings, he's got a cape. And
one of the lesser known main baddies in the Nintendo universe, isn't he?
Aye, maybe. I always just thought he was quite cool. And he's a bit of a fucking Tory in this game. Meta Knight's trying to take over Dreamland because he thinks the inhabitants are too lazy.
Don't let a Belfast see that steaky, man. He's using fucking hell. It was lethal.
So obviously Kirby's not having this because he likes being lazy. So he fires himself at Meta Knight's airship, and you get a load of these timer-based levels where you've got a time limit to do a certain thing, like run through the level, collect your abilities, and then like destroy a cannon or destroy the engine or whatever. So you take down Meta Knight's airship, and then eventually you have a sword fight against the man himself, and interspersed throughout are all these quite funny wee kind of dialogue boxes where they'll be like, Sir Kirby has made it to the engine room, and some of them start like abandoning ship and things like that. It's cool.
Meta Knight gives you a sword because he wants it to be a fair fight.
Yes.
It's like this kind of chivalrous sort of lawful evil type of villain.
He's honourable, and he's one of these guys where like quite often he'll team up with Kirby against a bigger threat. I think as the series has gone on, he's turned out to be a wee bit like Star Wolf.
Aye.
You know how Star Wolf teams up with Star Fox nowadays?
Aye,
I know. It's an unusual structure, as I was saying, with this game, because it's like a number of different games. In most of them, the gameplay is very similar. It's the gameplay you expect for Kirby, but instead of one long campaign, you've got a couple of different campaigns just with different twists to them. Like the timer-based stuff and the fact that it's a remake of the first one, and obviously the Crown Jewel is one that you're going to be talking about shortly.
Very shortly.
Has there ever been a bad Kirby game? Universally?
Too many of them, I've not played them all.
I'm not really the best. Aero would have played quite a lot of them, and he's always seemed to enjoy them. He liked the N64 one and stuff like that. Generally speaking, I think they stay at a fairly consistently good level. There's probably ones that are worse than others. The final game that you unlock by finishing four of the other games is called Milky Way Wishes. That has Kirby travelling about different planets. Apparently it's the longest game. I only did like the first three or four planets. This changes up the gameplay yet again, whereby instead of absorbing enemies and copying their abilities, the copy abilities are hidden and secret rooms, so you have to hunt about and find the copy abilities, and then you can access them for a menu. Again,
cool.
a different wee slant. Aye, it keeps it fresh, it keeps it interesting. No, all that stuff's out the way.
Over it.
Easily, my favourite part of this game is that one of the game modes is called the Great Cave Offensive. To use the proper insider term, this is a search action game. It's the what cunts overused to death. It's a Metroidvania. You play as Kirby, kicking about this wee different interconnected cave system with all these different areas, and you're looking for 60 different treasures, and it's just this fucking magic wee tightly designed thing. It's got one of the gameplay loops that just fucking grabs my brain and says, you fucking like this, you're going to play this for fools.
It takes the thing you get in platformers where, like, oh, you found a hidden bit, here's an extra life, and just makes that the whole game.
Aye.
Oh, how am I going to get this treasure? Like, what kind of mad path am I going to take to get this one?
It rewards curiosity constantly. You know, you're always pretty much going to get something for going, why is that block a different colour for the rest of them? It's just set up that way. Makes you feel really clever for working it out. And it rarely punishes you harshly for failure. It's quite forgiving. It's a Kirby game. Kirby's power set, by the way, and the more I think about this, is actually fucking uniquely well designed for this style of game. See, like, Symphony of the Night, where you'll find a type of barrier, and it'll be like, it'll be a grate or something, and you'll think, how do I get through that? You go and you'll find, oh, you get a magic spell that lets you turn into mist. So then you go, right, I can go back to the grate. Kirby is constantly changing about his power set. So, see, throwing in, I don't know, an area that you can only unlock if you get the hammer power, or, you know, a rope that you can only cut if you've got the sword. These wee things are fucking everywhere. So lots of experimentation with the different powers, trying to remember when to backtrack when you've got a power. Just fucking great, man.
Oh, I didn't actually realise that was part of it. I didn't get far enough to kind of make that, have that light bulb go off. That is really cool.
Yeah, that's the first bit. The treasures are kind of, you know, if you just played through the areas, you'll find the first 10 probably. It's when they start getting a wee bit better hidden. There's bits where you have to backtrack a good bit. If you get somewhere and you go, oh fuck, I was meant to have the stone power up here, you know, you'll need to run all the way back and get it if you're trying to get all the treasures.
Aye, because the baddie that has it is in like a good few screens away from where you need to use it.
Aye, exactly. So you end up getting quite good at remembering routes through the levels as well, doing it the most fastest and the most efficient way. A lot of the treasures as well, and this is just a nice wee cherry on top, if you're a Nintendo heed, they are all, no, they're not all, a lot of them are nods to different Nintendo things. You get Captain Falcon's helmet, you get the screw attack for Metroid, you get the Triforce for Zelda, and I think I was saying to yous on the chat, the best one of all, the bold Mr. Saturn for Earthbound.
Aye, he's in it, man. That was quite surprising.
Well, you got to remember, this is Japanese made, so they weren't thinking, oh, we'll make this for the American market and nobody bought Earthbound, so nobody will know who Mr. Saturn is. Earthbound was a smash hit in Japan, so people would be like, yes, Mr. Saturn. You know, he would be one of the main references.
So how laboratories who make the Kirby series, probably these days are better known for the Smash Bros. Series. The inclusion of like these wee treasures is quite similar to the trophies that you would eventually get in all the kind of Nintendo memorabilia in Smash Bros. And there's a Great Cave Offensive shows up as a level in the later Smash Bros. Games, and the tune from like the second stage, that's a kind of Kirby's little tune in the Great Cave Offensive level. So yeah, I think that obviously how Kirby gets a lot of attention in the sort of Smash Bros. Games because it's about all the different Nintendo properties, but Kirby is Hal's property, so that's their favourite.
There's common lineage there, and apparently Satoru Iwata gets subbed in quite late in the game in Earthbound to help out with programming and stuff like that as well. So yeah, you know, there's common ancestry in amongst all these things.
Aye, for sure.
It's one of the Nintendo IPs that I suppose will always go with them. It's got that kind of slot at the end of the, as we said, at the end of the console kind of era, but the console life. But like, I'm wondering I just wish they gave as much love to Star Fox as they did as Kirby. But it's good to know that they're still keeping. I mean, they could focus just on Mario and that's it, I suppose. So in fact, they're still getting constant Kirby around it. Gives us hope, doesn't it, for future runouts for different guys.
HAL Laboratories are nominally independent for Nintendo, but they're pretty much like, you know, a partner company of Nintendo, so they've kind of got their own thing going on. I think just as a team of developers, they can be trusted to make pretty good stuff, whereas Star Fox was kind of, you know, handed off to all sorts of different teams over the years. Some have done better than others at it.
You need to get a British mob back together, didn't you?
Aye, the OG team, man. But aye, I could go on at length about this. There's a lot of really cool bosses. The funniest one in the Great Cave Offensive is called the Computer Virus, and it mimics like a wee 8-bit kind of RPG battle where the enemy appears in this box and like text appears above the screen, and then when you kill it at the end, it says Kirby get 20 experience points, 20 tenderness points, 3 happy smile points, and it gives you all these like irrelevant points. I just thought that was funny and quirky.
Class.
But yeah, in case you couldn't tell, this is a fucking heavy recommendation for me, mostly for the Cave Offensive level. It will definitely be on my end of the year list unless there's games coming up that blow it out the water, and I'll be going back and getting the fucking last 7 treasures, because at last count I'm at 53 out of 60, so I've only got 7 to go.
Those last ones must be pretty solid.
Aye.
Proper brain scratchers then.
I've got the last 3. It's sort of, there's a wee hang in the middle between 50 and 60, so I think there must be an area I've missed.
Aye.
Sort of hidden away somewhere. So I'll get back to it and I'll fuck about, because I'm not going to finish every game on it, but I need to get the 60 treasures, man.
Aye.
No, I'm glad you enjoyed it. And I think, do you reckon, like, even if it was just that game on its own, you probably would have had it up the top?
Yes. I think if they made a Kirby game that was just this, I think they're missing a trick no day in that. As I say, I think with Kirby's power set, it's uniquely fucking, it's custom made for one of these fucking Metroidvania type things. And I don't know why it's never been, you know, probably because people would go, oh, they're just trying to do a Super Metroid because that's what everybody does now. But they've been doing it since the 90s, come on.
Aye. Funny you mention
anyway.
That.
Aye. Well, aye, that brings us nicely onto our games for next time, I suppose. I'll just, I guess playing this, it's got my wheels turning. So, Mr. McCormick, I'll be giving you one of the greatest video games ever made. And I'm saying that quite matter-of-factly. I don't think there's much fucking debate in it for me. It's Super Metroid.
Amazing. Been wanting to give this a proper go for ages and ages, but I've been waiting until somebody blessed me with it on the podcast, so I can't wait for that one.
I'm a couple of years into it already, man, and it's, oh, leave it for next time.
You were chonking to talk about it.
Oh, it's dynamite. Oh.
So I'm going to be giving Andy another one of Nintendo's B-team, but this is, well, this mess specifically is Mario's twisted evil compatriot. It's Wario Land 4 for the Game Boy Advance.
Ah, nice one.
His runouts are always quite interesting. So
it's class. That's like a sequel to the old Game Boy games, isn't it? The old Mario games.
Aye, but they are part of the Super Mario Land series.
Aye, we covered this before, that's right. Aye, excellent, cheers. Aye, so I thought, right, Dynamite Neddy, what are we missing? And I think we've not had many puzzle games on here. We've talked about Tetris quite a lot. We've done Columns way back once a time, Columns 3, I think it was.
Aye.
But
Stone Spider.
We're going to get
that
a bit.
That was the episode where we did, oh, you know, the highest of highs with Chrono Trigger, Phantasy Star 4, Columns 3.
Okay, COVID around the corner. Aye, but, aye, so I thought Puyo Puyo, sort of a Japanese version of Tetris, well loved. It's a brilliantly addictive game. And I'm going to give you the PAL version of that the European version of that for the Mega Drive, which was, for some crazy reason, named Dr. Robotnik's Mean Bean Machine.
Yeah.
So we'll have a talk about that next time round, plenty to say about it.
Right back to our roots with fucking obscure Sonic spin-off games, man. You can't beat it.
Aye.
Well, aye, lads. Nice one. Finally got this fucking episode out of the way.
Aye.
And we've even got a fucking live reaction to a new Sonic game.
Which is interesting. And by the way, might as well just get it out there. Next time's going to be quite special because Super Metroid, that's one of the big hitters, isn't it? It's one of the ones that we all love.
Oh, for me, this is something I could replay once a year, forever. But anyway, we'll get into all that.
Get the lights off. Get fucking Super Metroid on, man. Get lost in a big dirty spaceship, aye.
Aye, exactly. So, it's up the workers for me.
Up the workers for him.
Aye, me too.
You said one job, and it was to come up with sign-offs. Andy, you had a Japanese phrase you'd learned last time, and what's happened?
I don't know, I just want a channel if to do it on easier. Would do it again.
No, signing off in disappointment, see you later.